There was in Joppa a disciple named Tabitha, which translated means Dorcas. She was full of good works and acts of charity. In those days, she became ill and died. And when they had washed her, and they laid her in an upper room, since Lydda was near Joppa, the disciples, hearing that Peter was there, sent two men to him, urging him, "Please come to us without delay." So Peter rose, went with them, and when he arrived, they took him to the upper room. All the widows stood beside him, weeping and showing tunics and other garments that Dorcas made while she was with them. But Peter put them all outside and knelt down and prayed, and turning to the body and said, "Tabitha, arise." She opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up, and he gave her his hands and raised her up. Then calling to the saints and widows, he presented her alive. And it became known throughout all Joppa, and many believed in the Lord.
Good morning. We are going to be in Acts, the 9th chapter, here in just a moment, continuing our series out of Acts. But before we get there, quite a lot of you had questions last week. You were curious about updates about the camp at Frog Road, and I thought I would say a word or two while you're all in front of me. That way I don't have to answer them repeatedly, and it's easier for me that way. We did, so we announced last week there was a catastrophic fire at Frog Road Camp, and a substantial portion of that burned down. Our first priority last week was to figure out a place for our kids to go to camp this summer, and I think we've got a good jump start on that, and we've made arrangements through individual donors that are still coming in. Yes, if you're thinking about donating, that's still you, to provide half of the fee that they would need to go to the other camp we've selected this summer. So we're still taking donations from that. If you'd like to be involved, see the office. And then Saturday, I finally got to go out. It's the first time I'd seen the fire damage in daylight. I had seen it before at night when I ran out there the night that it happened, but I got to see it in daylight, and I was actually more disappointed in daylight than I was at night. There were actually parts of it that I were hoping had come out okay that hadn't, and it was a pretty depressing scene. We had a board meeting, and I think a wise decision was made, and that is it's a good group of fellows that are on the board. The three guys that I work with on the board are some of the most compassionate and kind-hearted fellows you're likely to see, with a real zeal for that camp. We decided it was too big a decision for four guys around a picnic table to make on a Saturday evening. That just didn't make any sense. And so the board is going to take 6 weeks and approach the churches that have in the past or are currently using the camp and basically ask, is there anybody who wants there to be a camp here? If there's 5, 6, 7, 8 churches that say, yeah, we'd really like to use the camp, would you please rebuild it, then the next phase will be to figure out how to do that. But the first question is whether it's of any value to anybody. So we're going to be spending the next 6 weeks talking to churches that have in the past or are thinking about being involved in the camp, and we appreciate your continued prayers as we try to discern what the best possible outcome is in that scenario and be wise with all the resources the Lord puts in our way. Today, we are going to continue in the book of Acts. We've been looking at the why of Christianity, just trying to explain to ourselves and to others some of the significant and curious features of this thing called Christianity. And today, we will be in the 9th chapter, beginning in verses 36 and 42, asking the question, why care? Which may not be the best title, it's just kind of what I came up with. That there is a feature of Christianity that relates to the compassionate nature of Christians that sticks out like a sore thumb when you look at Christians in the Bible, Christians in church history, and Christians today. Their compassionate spirit is unusual. In our modern times, we are so used to the compassionate nature of Christians as the fabric of American society that we don't even notice anymore that it's strange. But in fact, it has always been unusual to see people behave in the way that Christians do. Why might a person help another person? If you had to sit down, last week we were talking about conversion, and we said, why might a person convert? Tonight, this morning, kind of the same question. Why would a person be selflessly generous to another human being? What are the motives for that? And if you had to ask yourself, just kind of looking around, to be fair, Christians aren't the only nice people on the planet. There are other people that help other people. Why do people help other people in general? Well, if they are close family or kin. If your own people are in trouble, typically there's kind of like a bottom standard of decency. I may not take care of anybody else, but they're related. I've got to take care of them, right? I mean, you find people in our culture that may not have a bit of religion anywhere in their being, but, you know, well, they're my family. Even that we can't take for granted, if our culture has taught us anything in the last few decades, that even that, what we might call natural affection, is quite often lacking. But it's not unusual to see it, okay? We'll take care of our own people. Okay, fine, fair enough. Also, I'm happy to be selfless if I don't actually have to be selfless, would be option number two. If helping you in the long run gets something for me, then I'm pretty well happy to do it. And usually when people give, they're kind of measuring that out in some way. And most programs of giving have that in mind. I'll give you an example. Yesterday at our board meeting, we were talking about donors, and there is an oil company that has found some oil underneath Lake Keystone that has talked to us in the past about maybe buying some of the property or using the oil rights that the camp owns. And we said, I wonder if they would make a donation to the camp. But how do we talk about that? We don't expect the oil company in the kindness of their hearts to say, we should build you a church camp. But it's possible if they got something out of it, right? A big tax write-off, they got some oil mineral rights that they had been kind of wanting anyway, if there was some good publicity. You know, there might be a scenario where if you could convince them they got enough out of it, then they would be willing to do something that looked selfless when in fact it wasn't. And before you say, yeah, that's the way oil companies work, that's the way we all work, right? That's the way fundraisers work. There's a reason our kids come home from school like every other day with a new fundraiser. Because they figured out at schools that if you just tell parents, give us money, they get a little cranky about that. But if you say, give us money in exchange for cookies, you know, we can say, okay, I know it's overpriced, but hey, we're helping the school and I get to eat. And so my selflessness is not entirely selfless. Even a good feeling. You know, you feel good. You feel morally superior when you give to somebody in need. If it doesn't cost me very much and I get a good feeling out of it, sometimes I would trade that, right? Even again, a kind of godless, irreligious person would say, it makes me feel good. It doesn't cost me that much. Sure, I'll help you. So reason number two, if you get something out of it that you feel like, yeah, it's kind of worth it, then maybe we help somebody else. And third, and this is maybe the most important, if it doesn't really cost me too much. Who gives? In general terms, in our secular culture, who gives, we assume it's people that have it to spare. One of the most generous people in the last two decades in our civilization has been Bill Gates. By numbers, he has been an enormous donor to philanthropic activities. We're talking about numbers in the billions he's given away. He also hasn't missed it. Okay? He's one of the wealthiest people on the planet, and so it doesn't cost him a lot to be generous. And I'm not trying to put that down. It's a great thing that he did. But all of us, when we give, typically say, at what point will this kind of giving become inconvenient? I'm happy to give right up until the part where you cut into my mortgage payment. I'm happy to give right until you cut into, like, you know, where my vacation was going to be. When does it start inconveniencing me? So what I'm trying to say, in just typical civilization that we live in, these are the kind of things that we think about when people help other people. So now I want you to read with me. This is a topical sermon, so we're not going to spend as much time in this text as I might like. But I want you to look at Acts chapter 9 and just let her be an illustration for a moment of something different. I know it's Mother's Day. I don't have 3 points about motherhood in a poem, but we are going to talk about Tabitha, okay? So here is this magnificent feminine example that every woman ought to aspire to. She's described in verse 36 with these simple words. She was full of good works and acts of charity. Okay? She's a generous, kind-hearted person. What makes her different than every other kind person you've ever met outside of Christianity? I want to point out that what makes her different. Last week I said Paul's conversion was different because none of the normal reasons a person converts applied. Same thing true here. The generosity and charity of Tabitha is different because none of the normal reasons that were generous apply to her. So take a look, for example. Does she only help people like herself, family, friends, close kin? When you look at the text, there's actually evidence that that is the opposite of the case. Look with me for just a moment in verse 36 again. Chapter 9, verse 36. There's a detail that's easy to overlook. Now there was in Joppa a disciple named Tabitha, which translated means Dorcas. She was full of good works and acts of charity. There's not a detail on the page that's not important in the Bible, and there's something there that you can overlook. She's given to us by two names. In fact, when I was telling Celine what I was preaching on, I said, I'm preaching on Tabitha. She says, who? Tabitha. Who? Dorcas. Oh, yeah, Dorcas, right? All of us kind of, whichever one our Bible teacher used, in grade school somewhere, you were either taught the story of Dorcas or the story of Tabitha. Which one is it, Debbie? Is it? I don't know. One or the other, right? You learn one, and that's the one you remember. I learned that it's Tabitha, so I keep referring to her as Tabitha. Some of you may have learned Dorcas. But it's interesting, the text gives her two names. Okay, those two names are not from the same language, not even from the same language families. She has one name that is what we call a Hellenistic Greek name, and one name that is an Aramaic or Jewish name. Okay, and it's not that they just sound alike. Okay, so my name is Benjamin, but if you were to meet me and maybe your background is a Hispanic, you might say, well, that's Benjamin. You say the J differently, right? But I don't have two different names. I'm not Benjamin in English and Ted in Spanish, right? Right? It's Benjamin, you're saying it differently. It's the same name. Dorcas and Tabitha don't even sound alike. They are two names that have the same meaning. They are both the word that means something loosely like gazelle or some kind of critter like that. It's a graceful animal. It's a nice name. Okay? But she's given the word in one language and then in another, and she has these two names that don't even sound alike. What kind of person has two names in two languages like that? Why? I'll give you an example of where that doesn't normally happen. There was a man we met last week in our Bible study named Saul of Tarsus. Saul is kind of one of those Hebrew-sounding Aramaic-type names. It's a Jewish name. The first king of Israel's name was Saul, right? When Saul goes out and starts preaching to the Gentiles in the book of Acts, they don't call him Saul Paul. They call him Paul, or in Greek, Paulus. He has a Gentile Greek-sounding name. And the Gentile folks call him Paul, and that's what he's known as from that time forward in the book of Acts. Whereas when he was only among his own people, he's known as Saul. Normally, the group of people you're with call you by that name, so much so that Saul, we think of his name even basically changing. Go find the verse, by the way, where it says, and then Paul decided to change his name. The verse doesn't exist. It's just a fact of the text that one day they're calling him Saul, and the next day they're calling him Paul. This woman has two names, and I want to suggest to you why, because she was indiscriminate about who she helped. In Acts, the 6th chapter, one of the first controversies for the early church was that we had Greek widows and Jewish widows, and the Greek widows were being neglected. No one was taking care of them. And so they had a meeting, they complained to the apostles, because that always fixes everything. The apostles say, you fix it, appoint you some people to go take care of them. And lo and behold, if you read Acts chapter 6, the Greek widows were being neglected, and so they appoint six guys with Greek names to go take care of them, right? Let's find some Greek fellows. They'll go do it, and they did. Who is Tabitha Dorcas helping? She's known by both groups. They each have a name for her. This is a woman who is the very model of Christian compassion. She is indiscriminately helping. And two separate communities that had been ignored three chapters earlier, both are being served by this woman. Is she only helping her kinfolk and friends? It's not the way she behaves. Okay, well, what about that other one you mentioned? Does she get anything out of it? So we have a joke. Yvonne and I do, some of the fellows here do the count for the contribution on Sunday. And then it goes into a little vault. And then that safe opens up on Monday morning, and Yvonne and I recount it and make sure we get the same number. And sometimes, because of Sunday evening contributions, our count is higher than the Sunday morning count. And we always joke that if we're embezzling money, we're really bad at it. Because the number always goes up instead of down, right? We're embezzling out of our wallet into the bank account. If the number was consistently lower on Monday morning than it was on Sunday, someone says, what's going on there? But if it's consistently higher, she says, well, do we need to figure that out? I said, if we're embezzling, we're bad at it. Okay? Tabitha, is she trying to get something out of her generosity? If she is, she's bad at it. Who do you help if you want something from someone? People who have something to give. Who is Tabitha helping? It tells you in the text, it tells you more than once. When she dies, in verse 39, who shows up to mourn her? Widows. When she's raised back up in verse 41, who are the first people in line to cheer? Widows. Who has she been helping? Wealthy people. No. Widow. In the ancient world, widows are right down there with orphans as the people least likely to be able to have anything for themselves or give anything to you. To indicate how destitute they are, she's helping them by providing them with clothes. Right? We're not making crafts in our spare time. She's making them clothes because they haven't got none. Right? People with nothing to offer her in return are exactly the people she looks for. One of my favorite poems is by a poet named Yeats, who wrote a little poem about his wife at the time of her passing, and it's called Her Praise. Yeats's wife was an activist. She was very deeply involved in raising money for the poor, and in culture, in their society, the town they lived in, was kind of a nuisance to everybody, because every time you met her, she was asking you for money to go give to the poor, right? And so Her Praise is his poem about his wife, and he talks about how he went to parties. And he said, all anybody ever wants to talk about is politics. I want to talk about how great my wife was. And finally, at the end of the poem, he says, I figured it out. I was asking the wrong people. He says, if they be poor enough, they knew her name. And the poem ends with, though she had old men's blame, the poor, both young and old, knew her praise. Who does she help? Tabitha is known, she is mourned, and she is received with joy by the people who had nothing to offer her at all. Because that's how Christians do it. Finally, did it cost her anything? I want to suggest to you that there might be something else sneaky going on in the text. This is a little bit of Ben's reading into it. I'm just admitting that up front. You don't have to agree. I'm just going to tell you something I think is what's going on. I think her benevolence cost her more than the cost of fabric. Okay. In this story, the part of the story we tell our children in Bible class is that she died and Peter brings her back to life. Why does she die? I think we don't get it and we don't make the same assumptions because we are modern people. We live in a world where even the poorest among us have a standard of hygiene and health that would exceed any ancient standard. The ancient world was full of disease and death, and where you found that the most often was among the poorest people in your community who couldn't afford clothes to put on their backs. I want to suggest to you that in Christian history, and I'm going to prove it in a minute if you'll stay with me, there is a long track record of Christians going in to help poor people getting sick and dying because of it. It's what Christians do. How much did it cost her? Maybe everything. Maybe all of it. Do you see how Christian compassion is fundamentally different? It's not just her kinfolk. It's people that are different from her. She doesn't get anything out of it. It may cost her everything, and yet she gives. Why care? For Christians, when we read the story of Tabitha, of Dorcas, it's not even unusual behavior. Can I just pause here for a moment from the Bible part of this lesson and just give you a little bit of... I want to give you an example that's about 1,800 years old and one that's 2 or 3 years old, okay? And this is normal for Christian behavior. I want to go back to the 3rd century A.D., and I want to talk about the plague, because no one likes a good Mother's Day sermon without a plague in it, right? About the 3rd century... 250 to 260 AD, Western civilization, the Roman Empire, endured one of the worst plagues in human history. Until the medieval period, nothing like it had been seen. Absolutely catastrophic. And we don't get it, again, because we live in a society so far removed from the idea of mass plague. Okay, three kids get sick at school, we're shutting down. We have a whole different threshold compared to the ancient world and the plague. When we talk about the plague, something like 5,000 citizens a day died in Rome in that 10-year period. In the town of Caranus in Egypt, something like a third of the population died, and that's remarkable because it was a rural town. It wasn't a slum, it was a rural town, and still about a third of the population perishes. And in Alexandria in Egypt, historians estimate as many as half the population of Egypt's most enlightened, erudite city perished from the plague. And during this period of time, there are two responses. And we know because we have the documents of the people who survived it. Dionysius writes about the pagans and how they responded to the plague. At the first onset of the disease, they pushed the sufferers away and fled from their dearest, throwing them into the roads before they were dead and treated unburied corpses as dirt, hoping thereby to avert the spread and contagion of the fatal disease. The pagan world ran as fast as it could, including from their loved ones and family members, which we said even, you know, bare minimum, we help those, even them. Dionysius says, no, if you had the plague, your loved ones would throw you off the wagon and roll on. That was the attitude of the pagan world. How did Christians respond to the plague? Two sources tell us something very different. Heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ, and with them departed this life serenely happy, for they were infected by others with the disease, drawing on themselves the sickness of their neighbors and cheerfully accepting their pains. Pagans were running out, Christians were running in. Pagans were saying, get away from me, you'll get me sick. Christians said, bring it on. And went right in there and cheerfully died in order to help others. Cyprian in 251 says, how suitable, how necessary it is that this plague and pestilence, which seems horrible and deadly, searches out the justice of each and every one and examines the minds of the human race. Whether the well care for the sick, whether relatives dutifully love their kinsmen as they should, whether masters show compassion for their ailing slaves, whether physicians do not desert the afflicted. Although this mortality has contributed nothing else, it has especially accomplished this for Christians and servants of God, that we have begun readily and gladly to seek martyrdom while we are learning not to fear death. Christians saw the plague like they saw crosses. It was an opportunity to suffer and die doing good, and they ran in while others ran out. Rodney Stark's book on the growth of Christianity in the first five centuries of the Western civilization says this is how it happened. When everybody's doctor ran away, Christians ran in, and people said, who are you people? And by the end of that century, Christianity was becoming quickly the religion of the Roman Empire. And I want to suggest to you that hasn't even changed. Now, maybe it has in some ways, but not in others. Remember just a couple of years ago, it was 2013 Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Do you happen to remember who the first malaria victim of American citizenship was in the West African Ebola problem? It's a guy named Kent Brantley, member of the Southside Church of Christ in Fort Worth. Everybody else is air vacuuming out. Kent Brantley's running in. He and his team of doctors are doing medical mission work, and he ends up contracting Ebola himself. I saw an interview with him just the other day, and it's been a couple years now, but I saw a more recent interview, and he's talking about going back. He's saying there's still sick people, they still need us. Christians just don't see it the same way. They see the whole world through a different lens, fundamentally different. What does the modern pagan say? We don't have ancient Roman pagans, but we've got something. So I dug a little bit. This source is 30 years old, and I apologize for that, but you can go with it because I think the attitude hasn't changed. There was a book written in 1990 by famous atheist Richard Dawkins called The Selfish Gene, if that hints at the attitude of the book. And he explains human nature with these words. If you look at the way natural selection works, it seems to follow that everything that has evolved by natural selection should be selfish. Has modern science made us better, more altruistic, giving, compassionate people. Dawkins says, I'm an evolutionary biologist. There's nothing in your DNA that makes you a good person. Is he opposed to being good? No, let me give him credit. At the end of the book, he makes this sentiment, which I thought was kind of funny. Let us try. Let us try to teach generosity and altruism because we are born selfish. Because we, let us understand that our own selfish genes are up to, because we may then at least have the chance to upset their design, something no other species has ever aspired to do. Yeah, it'd be nice if you were compassionate. Can't figure out why you would, but he said that'd be great. You see, two fundamental differences of how we view other people. Christians don't ask the reason, what's the reason why we care? We say, which of the 10,000 reasons we have for compassion do you want? We look at compassion completely differently. Because every human shares the image of God, including the one you're running away from, and including the one that doesn't look like me and sound like me, including the one with sickness, disease, and hurt and wounds. Every person is made in the image of God, and the Christian says, we're going to help that person. The Christian says, we love because God loved us first. He always has, he always will, and that's why we extend that love to other people. We love, even when it costs us something, because Christ showed us that you give until it hurts. Christ showed us you give until it kills you. Christ showed us you give no matter what the cost. Because we take it very seriously. It's not a motto, it's not a bumper sticker, it's not a cliche. We take it very seriously when he says to us in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12, so whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, for this is the law and the prophets. We take that seriously, and we don't stop. And if you see in Christianity something fundamentally different than anything else you see anywhere else, and you should, then I would encourage you to ask yourself, why do these Christians care? And what is it about their Lord and Savior Jesus Christ that makes them think that way and live that way? If you're a Christian, live up to that aspiration. Show the world that Christianity means it. If you're not a Christian today, recognize what that is and what that good and what that has done for our whole society and what it continues to do. We love God and we love you because he loved us first. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If there's anything we can do to help you with that, won't you come?